Well, thank you so much, Caroline, and big gratitude to everyone at Sangha Live for bringing us together this morning. And a big hello and a warm welcome to all of you all across the continent, across the oceans, and coming together from many different corners of the planet today, it seems. So really honored to be here. I want to begin with deep honoring and a respectful acknowledgement of the land where I am in the San Francisco Bay Area, which has been stewarded and lived on by the Ohlone tribes for many thousands of years. And also to acknowledge the history and the life-giving beauty of this earth all around the planet, wherever you are. I also want to share just a really warm and wholehearted welcome to each of you and all of who we are, all of the different things that we bring to our life, our different backgrounds, shapes, sizes, education backgrounds, languages, religions, traditions, gender identities, whoever you are, and all of the different parts of who you are. I want to extend a really warm and wholehearted welcome. I'm glad you're here. And I'm looking forward to spending this time together exploring how we can make the most of our spiritual practice and our time together on the planet. So we'll do a little meditation together. Then I'll offer a short talk with some reflections and aim to leave some time at the end for questions and discussion. So why don't we go ahead and begin? If you're not already, I invite you to find a comfortable posture, one where your body can feel relatively relaxed and at ease. So really just checking that your body feels stable. You might notice the places where your body touches the ground, your feet on the floor, if you're sitting on a chair or a cushion, noticing the support of that steady contact beneath you. And just giving yourself a few moments to shift gears and settle in. So really listening to see what would be supportive for you right now. Maybe a little bit of movement in your body. Maybe a few slow, deep breaths. And in your own time, you can turn your attention inwards by closing your eyes or just letting your gaze be downcast. And you might check to see if you're holding any tension or tightness anywhere in your body that could be softened or relaxed. And so common places many of us hold tension are the jaw, the eyes or the eyebrows, but just checking those areas out. And just imagining what would it be like to have those muscles be totally relaxed, totally at rest. Imagining that your spine could lengthen upwards, the space between each vertebra expanding ever so slightly and opening in particular this region at the back of the neck, the occipital joint at the base of the skull. And one way of doing that is to allow your chin to drop just half a degree and you'll feel the back of your neck lengthen upwards. And you can do this whether you're standing, sitting, or reclining. And letting your attention settle down through the rest of your body, through your shoulders, down through your arms and hands, down the fronts and backs of your torso, and the sides of your torso. down into your pelvis, the large muscles of your upper legs, the knees, down into your shins and calves, becoming aware of your ankles, the tops, sides, and soles of your feet, all the way into your toes. And just seeing if you can become aware now of your whole body, whatever posture or position it's in. Sensing its warmth, its weight. And bringing a responsive listening to your experience. So how is it to be aware of your body right now? Maybe it feels blank or numb, just noticing that. Maybe it feels tense or uncomfortable, anxious or buzzing. And so if the body is unpleasant in any way, pain, tension, just seeing what's needed to find a balanced relationship with that. Maybe you widen your attention to notice the space around your body or the sounds in the room where you are. Kind of taking a very wide lens. Maybe the body feels comfortable and at ease, and you can simply allow your attention to settle and rest with the sensations of your body. And as with any meditation instructions, never giving up your own wisdom. So you are the authority on what's needed and what works for you. So if any of these suggestions aren't supportive, then you just leave them aside and you use what works for you. Listening for what kind of anchor would be supportive for you today. What's a home base where you can begin to rest your attention and let things settle and gather? So for some of us, that might be the body as a whole, or a particular part of the body, like the hands or the contact with the seat. For some, it might be the rhythm of breathing. Feeling the gentle sensations of the body breathing in and breathing out. For others still, it might be sounds. The experience of hearing, coming, and going. Now, whatever that anchor is for you, seeing if for this time you can put everything else down, all of the projects, the uncertainties, the conflicts, even the doubts and the questions. You just let everything be and come back to the simplicity of one moment, just feeling this right here. The past is a memory, and the future hasn't arrived. Allowing ourselves to receive each moment of being alive right here, right now. And so regardless of what meditation technique we're using, whether you're following my suggestion of taking up an anchor, or you're doing some other technique, open awareness, loving kindness, there's the technique that we're using, and then there's how we're approaching it. So you might just check and see, how are you holding the meditation in your mind, in your heart? Is there a sense of tension, of pushing, kind of trying to get it right? A certain quality of friction or struggle? What would it be like to soften that grip just a little bit? We're still applying effort, we're still showing up, but can there be a sense of ease, a sense of relaxed exploration? Perhaps even a quality of playfulness. Let's give this a try. Let's just see how this is today for me. And so depending on what's happening in your experience, you might check and see what's most needed, what's supportive right now. It might be staying with the simplicity of using the anchor, just continually setting aside all of the thoughts, the impulses and memories that come to mind. You just let them be like a song in the distance. You keep gently returning your attention, beginning again, coming back to this one experience of the anchor. Other times, what's most supportive, what's needed, is to actually be with what's occurring in your body, your heart, or your mind. When those experiences really assert themselves, they're no longer like a song in the distance. It's actually right here in front of you. Then maybe we let go of the anchor and we just give our attention to that experience and see, can I find balance with this? Can I allow this experience to live its life through me? These thoughts, these feelings and emotions, without getting swept away, but also without resisting or trying to control it. Like a wise old grandmother, listening and observing. The different phenomena that come through our consciousness. Patient, loving, understanding. Just aiming for that way of relating. So as we practice together for these next few minutes, just seeing what's needed for you, the simplicity of the anchor, or that balanced perspective of being with what's happening and letting it unfold. Thank you so much for joining me for that. It's lovely, lovely to be quiet and practice together. So just giving yourself a few moments to transition, bringing some movement back into the body, maybe even looking around the space where you are, and kind of orient to the environment, check things out. So I wanted to share some reflections today on how we understand meditation, mindfulness practice, in terms of some of the goals that we have and how to evaluate our practice. Last time I was here, a couple months ago, we talked about how kind of getting fixated on the idea of improving ourselves can be a little bit of a trap. You know, that if we start from this sense of I'm going to become something better, we set ourselves up for a fall because the very nature and structure of the personality is inherently incomplete and unsatisfying. And the difference between that and having aspirational goals to orient towards in our spiritual practice. Now, of course, we have goals. We all come to spiritual practice for a reason, whether that reason might be wanting to feel less stressed, needing to deal with difficult emotions like anger or grief, bitterness, longing for more forgiveness. We might be wanting to clear our mind or just rejuvenate. Maybe we have chronic pain and we're looking for some healing. Or it could be a longing for inner peace or more freedom, or simply curiosity, just exploring. So whatever it is that's calling us or that's bringing us to meditation and spiritual practice, this question comes up periodically and regularly. Like, is it working? Now, how do I measure my progress? How do I evaluate this, especially if we're not seeing or experiencing changes in the particular area that has brought us to the practice? So if we're looking for relief, say, from anger, and we're not seeing changes, or we want more inner peace and we're not feeling more peaceful, how do we understand that? And the way that mindfulness practice gets framed in kind of popular Western culture these days can really limit the way we understand and approach our meditation. Hence the kind of topic or title for today, how do we move beyond the notions of mindfulness as self-help and stress reduction to the fullness of what insight meditation, which is the roots of mindfulness, coming out of India, Burma, Sri Lanka, Thailand, Southeast and South Asia, how do we understand the fullness of the potential of insight meditation for transformation? I want to talk today about three different ways of relating to this question and understanding it. Like, how do I know if it's working? How do I evaluate my meditation? With the hope that understanding this better can reduce some of the suffering that we experience, particularly in relation to this question of like, is it working? How am I doing? And that hopefully it can provide some guidance and some clarity. But before even getting into any of that, I want to really normalize the level of distress and suffering we can experience around these very questions of how am I doing? Is it working? Am I making progress? Feelings of failure or doubt or comparing that can come up in our meditation practice. And the kind of tragic way that the mind can take spiritual practice and turn it into another thing to beat ourselves up about. I think it's rare to be on a spiritual path and not feel some of that doubt and self-criticism over how I'm doing. I distinctly remember many, many meditation retreats I have participated in earlier in my practice in the first, say, 10 years or so. Anytime a teacher would give a Dharma talk where they would talk about the concept of progress, the progress of insight, the different maps, the jhanas, all these different stages of, you know, attainment, I would just go into this total shame and doubt spiral of how much of a failure I am and how I can't do it. And there's something, you know, I'm not doing it right and I'll never get anywhere. It was torture. So first and foremost, I want to really normalize those feelings that I myself have felt very intensely and struggled with at various points of my own practice. Because that has been such a companion for me at different points in my practice, I wanted to share a few of my favorite quotes on the concept of failure, which has been one of the hooks for me in evaluating practice and being like, I'm failing, I can't do it. So this is from Winston Churchill in one of his moments of wisdom. He said, success is the ability to go from one failure to the next with no loss of enthusiasm. So one way of looking at it. This is from the motivational speaker, inspirational speaker, Alan Kay, who said, if you don't fail at least 90% of the time, you're not aiming high enough. So again, another useful way I've found to look at it. And one of my favorite quotes from Malcolm X, from his autobiography, children have a lesson that adults should learn, to not be ashamed of failing, but to get up and try again. Most of us adults are so afraid, so cautious, so safe, and therefore so shrinking and rigid and afraid that it is why so many humans failed. Most middle-aged adults have resigned themselves to failure. So a certain quality of resilience in practice and an understanding that the ideas of how we measure up, while they might have relevance in some contexts, are just part of the process. So how to make sense of this, how to understand this notion and relate to it wisely? So one of the things that I've found, so I'm going to talk about three different ways of understanding and relating to evaluating our practice. One is understanding the trajectory of the meditation path and how it unfolds. Two is moving beyond mindfulness and understanding the range of practice. And three is understanding what are the metrics? How do we relate to those? How can we use those and hold them lightly? So the trajectory of the spiritual path looks different for each of us, how things unfold. One of the most perhaps useful things that I've heard and been taught is that it's not linear, that the spiritual path is cyclical. So we think we've moved through something or overcome something only to find a month, a year, 2 years later, it comes back. And then we think, I thought I was making progress and here I am again, stuck with fill in the blank. And we can believe that means I'm not making progress, when in fact, it's like a labyrinth, right? Just as you think you're close to the center, to the goal, you get pushed out all the way to the outside again. Another metaphor that I've heard about describing the trajectory of the spiritual path is it's not just cyclical in one plane, but it's like a three-dimensional spiral. So you could think about it, say going down. So we're going around, but we're also changing going down. So we're going deeper and deeper, but in these cyclical patterns. So the material of our psyche and our consciousness that we are transforming and coming to understand and relate to differently comes up again and again at different layers of depth. And this is one way of understanding the trajectory that can help us to contextualize things when we're interpreting our practice and thinking, I'm failing, I'm not making progress, why is this happening? Another very important aspect of how the practice unfolds that's essential to understand along these lines of it not being linear is that for many of us, not for all of us, but for many of us, things get worse before they get better. It's like certain medicines when you take them, like if you take a cough medicine, if you take an expectorant, you end up coughing more but the cough becomes more productive. You actually cough out all of the junk that's stuck in your lungs. And practice can be like that sometimes. More of the junk and the gunk in our hearts and our minds that we have been avoiding or suppressing or kept at bay actually rises up to the surface to be experienced so that it can be released. And this can be very difficult and disorienting. We come to practice and we feel like everything's, okay, I've got some things to work on, but I'm relatively okay. And it seems like our life is falling apart or we're getting worse because we're meditating, when in fact, it can be a sign of progress. It's like all of the things that we've said no to for years, all of the feelings that we've ignored, all of the old hurts and wounds that we've been suppressing, all of the unresolved things that we haven't given time or attention to, come home. It's like once we're actually present and available, and we begin to develop some resource inside to really meet the truth of our life, our world, our relationships, our history, personally, collectively, those long forgotten feelings come home to be felt finally. It's like they've been knocking at the door for years, and every time they knock, we don't answer. We say, go away, I'm not home. Now all of a sudden the door is open, we're home. Well, guess who's gonna come in to visit? The key is that if we continue practicing, they don't stay. They come, they visit, we get to know them, and then they leave, they go on their way. So I had a very, very, very difficult experience with this early in my meditation practice when I was in India with one of my first meditation teachers, Anagarika Manindraji. This was the second time I had gone to India. I went back to practice with him because he was quite old at that time, and I knew that if I didn't go, I might not have a chance to see him again. And a lot of stuff came up. Anger, rage, violent images and memories. And I was overwhelmed. I couldn't handle it. I got really out of balance, in fact. And I went to see him and I was in tears. I was breaking down, saying, I don't understand what's happening. I don't know why this is happening. I feel like I'm failing. And he smiled and he said, when you tell me all of this, I'm so happy for you. And then he said something I'll never forget that totally threw me for a loop. He said, you must enjoy your suffering. And he wasn't being masochistic. He was understanding what was actually happening, saying all of this stuff that you're going through is part of the process of releasing the places you've been stuck. You can relax. It's okay. try to find some space with the discomfort and enjoy the process because it's leading to your freedom. Another way that we can understand how things unfold is that sometimes they get worse before they get better. One of the analogies that the Buddha used in the early text is it's like dyeing fabric. The fabric is the mind. The dye is the Dhamma, the teachings. And the Buddha said, when you dye a fabric, you have to wash it first. Otherwise, the dye won't take evenly. The fabric will have spots and splotches. So you need to clean the fabric first. And so you take the fabric and you put it in very clean water with some kind of, you know, surfactant. So what happens when you take a dirty cloth and you put it in clean water? All the dirt and the junk comes up to the surface. So this is another way, another metaphor that the Buddha used for understanding it. There's one other perspective here that can be very helpful, which is this kind of counterintuitive way that as we practice, the more mindful and aware we become, the more we see. The more we notice our reactivity, our pettiness. In fact, the more mindful we are, the more moments we notice that we're not mindful. For example, if you sit to meditate for 5 minutes and say you're lost in thought for 4 minutes and 45 seconds, and you have 15 seconds of mindfulness in the middle, you have one moment of waking up in mindfulness and then you're gone again. It's going to feel like you were only gone for one period of time and you were mindful for one period of time. Now, say in those 5 minutes, every 10 seconds, you come back to mindfulness and then you're gone for 10 seconds. Well, do the math. That means like 30 times you're losing it and coming back. It can feel like I'm getting less mindful. I was gone so many times, whereas before I was just only gone once. Actually, you're being more mindful. It's just that you're coming back more frequently and noticing all of the times you're not mindful. So all of these are different ways that the more we understand how the path unfolds, the more we can contextualize what's happening and not be so quick to judge and really recognizing that it's going to unfold differently for each of us. Another thing that I think can be important to mention, particularly as we look at the goals that we bring to practice and really longing for change and transformation, is, as I said in the meditation, not giving up your own intelligence and perhaps not putting all your eggs in one basket, depending on what your goals are. What I mean by that is, for certain kinds of transformation, other methods may be more efficient. Like, for example, if you're having marital difficulties and the only thing you're doing is mindfulness practice, maybe you want to see a couples counselor, right? Or if you suffer from trauma, mindfulness can help. And maybe you want to work with a trauma healing specialist. So to be intelligent about the method that you're applying based on your goals and aspirations, and to make sure that you're using discernment in that way. Okay. So this is one way of beginning to contextualize and relate to this question of progress and evaluation, is just understanding how things might look so that we're not applying a false expectation to our practice. Okay. Second, moving beyond mindfulness. So mindfulness gets all of the press. It's the one that we hear the most about in, you know, whether it's the meditation app or the spiritual magazine or the podcast. But as Sayadaw Utejaniya, the Burmese meditation teacher, has famously said, awareness alone is not enough. We need to bring our wisdom and intelligence to bear in the practice. This whole path is about learning. It's not just about being aware of what's happening. It's about understanding what's happening and transforming our relationship to it. We can be aware of, say, panic and still be flipping out inside. We can be totally aware of flipping out and still be spinning. So mindfulness isn't enough, just being aware. We have to also bring balance and wisdom. We need to bring other qualities into the practice. And this is where the teachings on the parami, the perfections, this range of other heart qualities that support and are supported by mindfulness come in. Things like compassion, patience, courage, wisdom, the discernment to know what's needed, what's helpful right now. I was pointing to this in the meditation that we did. Wisdom means understanding. Understanding, how am I relating to what's happening? Is this helpful? What's needed right now? What would be useful? Is what's useful coming back to the anchor and putting everything else down? Is what's useful making space for what's happening? Is what's useful talking to someone else and getting some support relationally? And ultimately, being able to take a step back from our meditation practice from time to time and really consider, what am I learning? What am I learning about myself? What am I learning about life? What am I learning about my place in the world? How I've been conditioned, the stories I've been told, and which ones are true and useful and which ones aren't. I remember one very clear insight I had into this, into this fact that just paying attention isn't enough. Again, this was much earlier in my practice. I was working as a cook at the Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts. And when you're on the residential staff there, there are two meditation periods a day that the staff are invited to come to, 45 minutes. We would sit in this little meditation area up in the attic. And so, doing my meditation diligently, sitting, following the breath, 45 minutes, the bell goes off. And all of a sudden, so the bell went off, and it was one of those meditations where I was pretty aware, I was trying to follow the breath, but a little bit lost in thought, but coming back to the breath, the bell went off, and I was like, all of a sudden, I was like really awake. And I realized in that moment, I was like, what just happened? Like, what was I doing for the last 45 minutes? I was trying to pay attention to my breath. I was even aware of my breath sometimes, but I wasn't really there with all of who I am. I wasn't actually fully interested and connected. I didn't learn anything. I didn't learn anything about even how to pay attention to the breath, because I was just kind of doing it from memory, what I was supposed to be doing, hoping that by following this instruction and just doing it, it would somehow magically make things better. It doesn't work that way. We really need to show up. We really have to be fully present with all of our heart and who we are. And be curious. We have to want to learn, to understand, to know, not in an obsessive kind of way where we're analyzing everything, but just in an open-hearted way where we're actually listening. It's like the difference between being on the phone with a friend who's telling you about something and kind of half listening. Because you kind of sort of think you know what they're saying already, and you're just kind of going, right? But your mind's not really fully there, versus really being present for that person, listening to what they say. Are we really listening in that way to what's unfolding moment to moment in the meditation? So one way of supporting that is to ask yourself these questions as you practice. Again, not obsessively, but just every now and then. Step back, ask yourself, how am I relating to what's happening? How am I relating to the meditation itself? Am I like, really, really pushing and struggling? Or is there ease? Is there curiosity? Is there playfulness? How am I relating to the breath, these thoughts, this sensation, this emotion? What's needed? What's really needed right now? Is meditation the most useful response? If so, what kind of meditation? Or even just more subtly, like, oh, what's needed is just to settle back a little bit. Oh, what's needed is a little bit of kindness to just be more gentle with myself. Ah. Oh, patience. It's okay. Give this time. That's what's needed. Again, we're not thinking about it. It's not like we're analyzing it. You just ask the question and then listen. Let the wisdom of your heart come forward. And in the long term, asking yourself from time to time, what am I learning? Not from a place of self-judgment or criticism or even doubt, but from a place of genuine interest. So this is a second way that we can begin to relate to these questions of progress and evaluation from a different perspective, understanding that insight meditation is more than just paying attention. It's really about transforming how we're relating to ourselves and life and how we understand what it is to be human by bringing all of who we are to bear in each moment. Okay, so the third way of thinking about this question of, is it working? There are certain metrics, not quantitative or numerical, but certain ways of gauging over time, is this working? It's a valid question. It's a valid question if, number one, it's coming from a genuine place rather than from a place of criticism, self-doubt, judgment, self-loathing, shame, inadequacy, all of those small places inside. When it's coming from those places, it's not a valid question, because everything will be filtered through that idea of who we are and how we are. When it's coming from wisdom, when it's coming from, you know, I've been doing this for a couple years now, meditating every day, reading, listening to talks. Let's take a look back and see, is it helping? Is the time and energy I'm bringing forward worth it? That's valid. We want to know that the energy we are putting forth in our life is effective. So it's valid. It's a valid question based on where it's coming from. It's a valid question based on when we ask it. It's not valid to ask that question every day. Probably not even valid to ask it every month. So we have to understand the timeline here in terms of how practice works. Someone once asked the Dalai Lama this question of, you know, do you ever evaluate your practice? And he thought for a moment and said, yeah, it's useful to do that. He said, every 5 or 10 years, I check. And then he said in his kind of inimitable, humorous way, he said, I noticed some small progress. So it's helpful to bear in mind, particularly for those of us who are coming to this path from a Western context, that the cosmology of the Buddhist tradition really looks at this practice in the trajectory of lifetimes. Now, you don't have to sign up for that metaphysical understanding of a human life to practice, to benefit from it, or to evaluate your practice. However, it's useful to bear in mind, what would it be like to take the long view here? Say, even to think about this in terms of one lifetime. You know, how are we living? Every day we're strengthening certain habits and patterns. Is there any trajectory? Where what are we trending towards in the way we're living? So when we consider this timeline, this factor of how long it takes to start to see changes, there's a certain amount of faith, a certain amount of trust that's required as one of my colleagues, Winnie Nazarko, says, you have to run the experiment. You have to actually give yourself over to the practice and then see. Now, of course, it's a long investment, you know, a couple years, 5 years. So yes, we want to know that it feels right, that we're receiving some benefit from, you know, day to day. And this is where finding joy in the practice is important, really learning how to enjoy the meditation. It's not like it's always going to be pleasant, but there's a certain aspect of learning how to practice as a kind of cultivation. We can develop a quality of appreciation for the simplicity, the stillness, just the sense of disengaging from the busyness of our own mind and life that brings a quality of enjoyment. And that in and of itself takes time to develop a taste for. So if the question is coming from a genuine place, if we're asking it at the appropriate level in terms of timelines, maybe 5 years is too long. Okay, 1 year, 2 years. How do we measure? There are different ways of checking, of looking. The Burmese teacher, Goenka, some of you are familiar with his meditation centers, his 12-day retreats. He was a huge proponent of the body scanning method of Vipassana. He was fond of saying there are two measures for our practice over time. This isn't the only measure, but I find it useful as one data point or two data points. He said, over time, when we practice, we become more grateful and more equanimous. So just checking and seeing over time, is there more gratitude in your life? Are you less reactive? Do you have a little bit more perspective or balance on some things in your life? Another way of thinking about it or looking at it, and it's for me, it's always been helpful to have different angles here because there isn't one yardstick. And again, it's so important. I can't stress this enough. These yardsticks aren't meant to now be another tool to beat ourselves up and say, look, here's more evidence for the fact that I'm a worthless failure. But rather to check and see, am I going in the right direction? And if I don't have the sense that I'm going in the right direction, that's really important information. Then it's important to check with a teacher and see, what am I doing wrong here? Am I off? Is my practice like not aligned in some way? If I'm not seeing the changes that, you know, I'm longing for or that are talked about. So more gratitude, equanimity. The general trend of the practice, tendency towards less control inwardly or outwardly, less domination, less inner or outer violence, more patience, more kindness, more tenderness. You will see these qualities increasing in yourself. Sorry, something fell down suddenly and startled me. So this is the general trajectory of the path. And now again, it's not necessarily like there are, you know, bright lights and, you know, fireworks, but we might notice that we take a half a breath in a place, in a situation where before we didn't. We might notice we're a little bit less judgmental or a little bit more kind to ourselves, to others. It might seem like a small difference, but it can make all of the difference in the world to someone or to ourselves, that half a breath of space or that little bit of kindness. Over time with this practice, we're less obsessively focused on ourselves. There's less of that unhealthy self-centeredness. But it's not that we have an unhealthy relationship with ourselves where we're totally self-effacing either. We come into a more balanced relationship with our own needs and other people's needs, where we're connected and honor our own sense of dignity, but we're also available and responsive to others. So the sense of self and the identity gets put in perspective more over time. The tendency is towards more generosity, more compassion. A really important sign often of progress on the path is a better sense of humor, particularly about ourselves and about life. We're able to laugh at ourselves more. We're able to laugh when things go wrong, as they inevitably will, like, of course. Many of these changes that I'm describing, gratitude, equanimity, less control and domination, more kindness, more patience, less self-centeredness, more generosity, more of a sense of humor, spring from a heightened awareness of impermanence. We are aware of and experience the nature of change in life more directly. When we are more connected to and aware of impermanence, we don't take things for granted as much. We don't take ourselves so seriously. We have more perspective. So maybe I'll end with another short story from my own practice, and then a tip from one teacher. So the sense of timelines, like how frequently are we checking or measuring our progress? Is it a valid question? Where is the question coming from inside? Again, when I was training in India with Anagarika Munindraji, I would go to him and ask him questions about the practice, about my meditation. I had a lot of questions, and not all of them were coming from a useful place. And at one point, he got a little bit frustrated with me in a loving way, like, this is not helping, Oren. And he said to me, he said, you're always checking. You take one step and then you stop and look and check. Did I take a step? Am I walking? Am I on the path? Did I really take a step? He said, just walk. Just walk on the path. So we have to give ourselves over to the practice, allow it to do its work. Our job is to just show up fully and really be sincere. So Bhikkhu Bodhi, the famous translator and teacher of many of the suttas and the Pali Canon, he is often quoted as one of the things he wrote in, I think, one of the introductions to one of his books. He said, there are only two things that are required to succeed in this practice. The first is to start practicing, and the second is to keep going. So I offer these thoughts for your reflection today. Thank you for your kind attention. Please take what is useful, and what's not useful, just let it be. So as we transition here, I also want to mention again that we are here together today through the generosity of this community. Every week, Sangha Live has a session, and we're able to be here because of the generosity of people who have come before us here at Sangha Live, and also in the Buddhist tradition. All of these teachings are available through the generosity of others, those who have practiced and those who have supported the practice over literally millennia. So My time here today is a gift. I offer it freely and joyfully. Sangha Live's time today here, Caroline's time is a gift. And there's an invitation to participate in this millennia-old cycle of giving and receiving. And if you feel moved to offer a gift to contribute to Sangha Live, to my work and teaching and practice, I think there's a little button to make a donation here in the meeting. And anything that is joyful and sustainable for you to offer is humbly and gratefully accepted so that this community can continue offering this space and these teachings, and also so that I can continue practicing myself and sharing these teachings with others. So thank you in advance with a really sincere and deep bow of gratitude for your support. So with that, we will shift gears now. We've got a good 20 minutes to some questions. So if you have questions about the reflections I shared, your meditation practice, or anything more broadly related to the Dharma, please feel free to drop those in the Q&A. I'll take those questions in the order that they are, that they're listed there in terms of the votes. You can upvote other people's questions. So from Sharon, I've recently become interested in jhana practice. I'm not sure how to approach this practice without striving to achieve a particular state. So thank you, Sharon. So the jhanas are states of deep concentration. They're meditative states, almost like trance states of absorption. And the word jhana literally means meditation. It's the word that the Buddha used to mean meditate. Jhayati is the verb, to meditate. So the interpretation of what the jhanas are, these states, varies widely. So for, you know, Sharon or others who are interested, there are certain books you can read just to get a sense of the terrain of how they are interpreted. My colleague Richard Shankman, in fact, I think I have his book here on my shelf, has a wonderful book called Samadhi, which means concentration, where he talks about the jhanas and the different interpretations of what they are. But to your question about striving, so this quality of trying to get somewhere comes up in our practice regardless, for many of us, of what our goal is, whether it's jhana or enlightenment or just less stress. It's very useful to understand how to relate to it and work with it. So I'll just share two or three pointers or tips here. The first is to normalize it, to recognize that when we care about something, we want to try really hard, and that's normal. And so instead of thinking of the striving as a problem, as an obstacle we need to overcome, get rid of, or fix, just consider it part of the landscape. It's gonna come up for most of us. It doesn't need to be a problem. Just be aware of it like you would anything else in your meditation practice. When you notice that contraction or tightness or rigidity or leaning forward of striving, just notice it. Oh, look, striving. Be aware of it. Let the mind come back into balance on its own. This is one thing that I've found very helpful to work with striving in practice. Another is understand, particularly in relation to samadhi and the jhanas, is understanding how these, how concentration works. You can produce a certain state of concentration through effort. It tends to be very rigid, and tenuous. It can be shaken or broken by minor disturbances because it's very held together with a lot of tension. The kind of stability and collectedness of mind the Buddha encouraged us to develop is much more flexible and dynamic. And that quality of settledness, collectedness, comes not from trying or pushing. It comes from ease. It comes from relaxation and enjoyment, coupled with singleness of intent. We have to be very clear about what we want to do, but then there's a quality of ease and enjoyment. So for example, think about something you love to do. Maybe it's playing the guitar, maybe it's cooking, maybe it's painting, maybe it's running. Doesn't matter what it is. You know those times where you're really in the zone? Where you're effortlessly present, everything else falls away. You're not striving or struggling to attain that state, are you? No. What are the components? What are the conditions that bring that state of intense focus, of being in the zone together? Interest, enjoyment, rapt attention. You're really like captivated by what you're doing because you want to be there. So these are the qualities to emphasize and focus in the meditation if we're seeking to cultivate concentration. Interest, wholeheartedness, and in particular, again, ease, relaxation, and enjoyment. If you look at the suttas, there's a list of progression towards awakening, and the causes that precede concentration are always happiness and enjoyment. Okay, so I hope that's helpful. Next question. Can you please speak to how we can mindfully remove ourselves from interactions with the more difficult personalities in our lives? I often think that having that tool is the answer, but I don't have to what would be useful right now. Yeah, thanks, Charlie. I'll say a couple things about this. It's a powerful question. It's an important and difficult area of our lives because we're not in control. And the Buddha talked about this in the very definition of suffering. He said, you know, being associated with people that you don't like is suffering. Being separated from the ones we love is suffering. So this is the nature of what it is to be human, is to have to spend time with people who are difficult for us. So I think fundamentally the most important thing to do is to look at why we're having difficulty with these people and understand our own reactivity, because that's the place we have the most authority and control over. We can't always have a say over who we are in relationship with in our lives, whether they're family, an employer, a neighbor, and so forth. That said, when we do have a choice, can we set limits and boundaries with love? So a lot of my work with communication goes into the skills for doing just what you're saying, how to mindfully and kindly remove ourselves from a relationship to say, hey, this isn't working for me. I wish you all the best, and I'm going to take some space now. So I'm teaching a 6-week course that starts tomorrow, actually, through the Barry Center for Buddhist Studies. It's a Dana-based course on wise speech, on the Buddha's teachings, on how to speak mindfully and lovingly in difficult situations in our life. So if you're wanting to learn more about like those practical skills, I'm putting a link in the chat right now. Let's see if that comes through. That would be a great place to learn more. And it's on my website. Okay, I've been struggling to focus at all during meditation for well over a month now. I know this is partly due to stressful circumstances and difficult memories surfacing, past trauma. Just finding it really difficult to keep finding motivation to keep meditating when I'm not feeling the benefit of meditation right now because I'm so constantly pulled away. Any thoughts on this? Yes, absolutely, Audrey. So first and foremost, want to express my tenderness for the difficult memories that are coming up. It can be very, very hard. And just to bring to mind again that metaphor the Buddha used of the cloth, cleaning the cloth, and the accumulated things that have kind of adhered to the cloth coming up to the surface. Those memories are coming to the surface, and maybe you don't need to hear this, you probably know this already, to be healed and released so that you're not carrying them anymore. So how to deal with them, how to relate to the meditation. A few really practical tips. One, meditate for shorter periods of time, particularly if it's really stressful time, if you're having trauma memories, sit for less, 5 minutes, 2 minutes. You could do it multiple times a day, but don't do longer periods of practice necessarily. Experiment with shorter periods of sitting. Two, try meditating with your eyes open. And even meditate on seeing and hearing more than on your internal experience, because the internal world of physical sensations, thoughts, and memories is very charged and difficult right now. So what may be more helpful and balancing for your nervous system and for your psyche is to actually meditate on more neutral experience that's external than the internal world. So sit outside with your eyes open and notice all of the colors and the movement and the light. Listen to the sounds of the birds and the traffic and the, you know, conversations that come and go. This is a second tip. The third tip is, if you're not already, make sure you're getting support professionally from a licensed mental health professional, a trauma healing person. And if there aren't resources financially right now for that, look into alternative forms of support from things like reevaluation counseling, good friends, community, sangha, so that you have that interactive and relational support to be with the difficulties. The releasing of those thoughts and memories, I'm seeing your question, Helen. It's a longer conversation, but yes, they're to be noted. We're aware of them, but then there's that sense of finding balance with them. We come into a right relationship with them, to feel them, let them be fully felt and known without getting stuck or caught in them. These are great questions, everyone. Really, really glad that you're asking. So Beth, how do you deal with when others aren't as enthusiastic about spirituality as you are, leaving you feeling alone on your path? Yeah. It can be lonely, it can be challenging. And we live in a time where the dominant society, at least in the West, particularly, is devoid of spiritual values. I think that for me and for many people, one of the most supportive responses to that is spaces like this, is community. We need to have community. We need to find and reach out and make those connections. So the people in your immediate circle in life might not understand what you're doing. They might even scoff at it or think negatively of it, family, close friends, colleagues, maybe even an intimate partner or spouse. So if that's the case, it's all the more important to find one or two Dharma buddies, people you can connect with, who do understand, who are interested in connecting and talking about the Dharma. And if you don't have a local community, there are many, many online communities like Sangha Live, like the community I run called Next Step Dharma. I'll put a link to that in the chat. We meet every 10 days online and talk about the Dharma. So find those connections. It only takes one or two connections to help to heal that sense of isolation and loneliness in the path. One other suggestion, Beth, is there is another way to find that connection, even when it's not available through community in the real time, even when it's not available online for some reason. And this is through devotion. This is through the heart. Somebody asked me, who are the pictures of the teachers behind you? So those are two of my main teachers behind me on one of my altars here where I meditate every day. One is a picture of Anagarika Munindraji, who I spoke of. The other is a picture of Ajahn Sachito. My two other main teachers have been Joseph Goldstein and Michelle McDonald. And of course, the Buddha, who's here behind me, two Buddha statues. So the Sangha refuge, the refuge of Sangha, means that we feel a connection, we have developed a connection with the lineage, with our own teachers, with our teachers' teachers, and ultimately with those who have come before us on this path. We don't walk alone. We are always accompanied by our spiritual ancestors and by our blood ancestors, by our land ancestors, by the people who have lived on the land before us. And when we come into right relationship with our ancestors, spiritually, familially, geographically, they become a source of support and strength and community internally in the heart. So speaking of community, I notice Caroline is putting some of the links for Sangha Live in the chat. If you're new to this community, you can connect with Sangha Live at any of those links. And if you're new to my teachings, I would love to stay in touch. Welcome to join me at any of the upcoming classes or retreats I have coming up. Maybe I'll take one more question and then we'll close out. So this is from Ruth. In learning meditation, when the arrows are flying by, I can watch them like clouds in the sky. When the arrows pierce my breast, I want to rip it out and stop the pain and bandage it, to not sit and feel it fully and examine it. Well, it's natural, isn't it? We don't like feeling pain. That's how we're built. So I think part of the practice is to honor that impulse to want it to go away, because that's the truth in the moment. That's what's real. You feel that urge to want to make it go away, to rip it out. Yeah, that's, be present to that experience. And then as we make space for that, the key is to start to differentiate. What's the difference between honoring what's happening and fighting, struggling, resisting? Because it's the resisting, it's the wanting to control what's happening that adds the second arrow, that adds the extra suffering on top, that makes it burn. And that's where we can start to investigate and distinguish. I know I said that would be the last question, but I want to answer your question, Caitlin, because it's a really important one. Caitlin's asking, how can I share mindfulness practice with others without proselytizing? Okay. Your practice is the best advertisement. Be in your practice. Let who you are and how you are be the example, be the teaching. There's that famous joke that's from a young practitioner who said, my parents hate me when I'm a Buddhist and they love me when I'm a Buddha. So be a Buddha and let that be the best advertisement for this practice. Okay, everyone. It's been a real joy to be together. I'm so grateful for your time and for your practice, for your support. Again, if you'd like to make a donation, really, really joyfully and humbly receiving and welcome for that here at Sangha Live and in my work. Sangha Live is doing these every week, so come back next Sunday. If you want to stay connected to me and my teaching, again, tomorrow my course at BCBS starts. I also have a retreat, an online retreat I wanted to mention that starts on Wednesday. And there's still room in it. Matthew Brensilver and I are teaching together. It's a small retreat, So it's a much more intimate setting. There's time for small groups and questions and discussion. And so all that information is on my website, orinjsofer.com. If you can take a couple days off this week and want to do a retreat, I would love to see you there. Otherwise, I look forward to seeing you down the line. All right. Many blessings, everyone. Take care. Be safe. May the merit of our practice lead to our full awakening for the benefit of all beings everywhere. Be well. Thanks so much, everyone.